Here it is!
From deep inside your radio.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, first of all, a tip of the show chapeau to the management of the New Orleans Hornets. Sorry, the New Orleans Pelicans. They're now the Pelicans basketball team, because I went to a Pelicans game this week, and the sound level on the arena PA is not as ear-shattering as it was when it was the Hornets. So congratulations for saving some folks who probably go there every night from some hearing damage. Thank you, Pelicans. Ladies and gentlemen, here's what I do for you. I go where the news is made, and I leave early. I was in New Orleans this week and attended a meeting of the Southeast Louisiana flood. I can't remember the whole name of the thing. It's the levee board. And I did so for a reason. You may remember last August or July on this program, I had as a guest John Barry, who at the time, not the composer of Goldfinger, but John Barry, the author of Rising Tide, who at the time was a member of that levee board, that authority, and who had spearheaded the action that the authority had taken in filing suit against 97 oil and gas companies for the damage they had wrought over the decades to the Louisiana, South Louisiana wetlands, the coastal marsh, which protects New Orleans, among other things, from the severity of storm surge and hurricane winds. And we talked about the likelihood, at the time it was even evident to him, that there would be political pushback to this lawsuit, particularly from Governor Bobby Jindal. And in the intervening months, that has certainly come to pass, to the extent that Governor Bobby Jindal has forced John Barry, through legal means, off the levy authority board, along with two of his allies. And so this was a meeting of the newly reconstituted board, which the lawsuit has been filed, but now there's pressure on them to somehow cancel the suit, or the legislature will force them to do it come spring. So there was a lot of to-ing and fro-ing. And I, as I say, I missed the firework. It was interesting in the morning, but then I had to go be an artist in residence at Loyola. So I missed the afternoon, which was described as fireworks in the newspapers, where the board members and the former board member, John Barry, clashed over the wisdom of screwing around with the lawsuit. And then, in what was the most interesting development of the day, apparently, the state of Louisiana's director of coastal protection and rehabilitation, restoration, a gentleman by the name of Garrett Graves, you may have seen him in my film, The Big Uneasy. He shows up to testify, and he doesn't spend as much time attacking the levee board's lawsuit as sort of hinting around that he and the state may be suing the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, to which we can all say, good luck with that. Now, Bobby Jindal is probably the last man in America who still thinks that there's a chance for Bobby Jindal to be elected president or vice president in 2016. Like, the Republican Party is going to, after 4.5, 5 years of Barack Hussein Obama, is going to nominate a guy whose real name is Piyush. Piyush. Just saying. Piyush. So he's currying favor, I guess, with the oil and gas industry, or maybe not. Maybe he's got, as Garrett Graves, his coastal restoration and protection authority chairman suggests, a secret plan for dealing with the oil companies to make them come to the table. That's a big table in some way. Meanwhile, as they say in the newscasts, other parishes besides New Orleans, two other suburban counties, or parishes as they're called in Louisiana, have filed their own suits against the oil companies. And John Barry told me personally this week in public that he thinks other parishes, other counties, will file their own suits. So keep watching or keep listening. Now, I have to say this, and it's a correction. It's not an apology, but a few weeks ago, I mentioned that a young girl by the name of Malala, Tom?
Malala?
Malala, had criticized the U.S. role in Afghanistan's thing. That's not the Malala that we know from Pakistan, who turns out to be Malala Yousafzai, who coincidentally this week has had her, or the last couple of weeks, has had her book. You know, she was the girl who was shot by the Taliban, shot in the head for going to school and for advocating education for girls. Her book has just been banned by Pakistani private schools because they allege she's a tool of the West, a Western tool. But that the woman who criticized U.S. in Afghanistan is, in fact, Malalai Joya, an Afghan woman activist. So we regret the error, as they say in the newspaper business. Now, this week, there have been, as the week ended, there were two stories, I think one in the New York Times, one in the Washington Post, each purporting to give details, behind-the-scenes details, as to the tumult that was happening in the White House and in the executive branch in the run-up to the debut of the Obamacare website on October 1st.
Harry, I don't have to listen to your phone calls to know what you're doing.
Thank you, Vice President Joe Biden, but this doesn't concern you, sir. But thanks for weighing in anyway. So there was tumult. And without, you know, going into too much detail, because I'm not too much of a detail guy, what I got out of the stories was the thrust was that people knew that stuff was going wrong. And officials kept saying they were being briefed by the companies developing the software. And they kept saying, well, we have these problems, you see, and we need more time for testing and everything. And the administration's response was, it's a hard and fast deadline, October 1st. Fix it. So I guess their attitude towards leadership is when people tell you that we need more time to solve a problem, leadership is saying, no, it's a real deadline. Fix it. Now, that may work when it's policy, but when it's software, we see what the result has been. It's a variant of what we saw, what we've seen in a lot of administrations, I think. We certainly saw it in the Bush administration, the attitude from the top being basically, don't bring me bad news. And for good reason, because if they bring you bad news, you have to develop a plan B. And in this situation, as in the quite fine book about the early days of the Iraq War fiasco, in this situation, both the Times and the Post, I think, reported that there was no backup system in case the website went down. If you don't have bad news, you don't need a plan B. Hello, welcome to the show.
Mama Ruth, you are the queen of the little red, white, and blue.
Mama Ruth,
you are the queen of the bye, boy. Tell yourself to die, boy. Medicine man got heat, strong power. You know better than to mess with me. She was the queen of the little, little white and blue. She was the queen of the little, little white. Come on, boy, now follow me. Wham, bam, hang the hand. Come on, boy, now follow me. And wham, bam, spray and sand. Come on, boy, now follow me. Wham, bam.
From just off Leicester Square in London, England, where they're erecting some kind of tower of candy canes for your Christmas enjoyment, I'm Harry Shearer, welcoming you to this edition of the show, celebrating this week the birthday of Dr. John. And we'll be featuring his music on the broadcast today because that's how we roll. And now, rolling into the apologies of the week.
Yeah. is so sorry.
Dateline London security firm G4S has apologized for overcharging the British government for its electronic tagging of offenders, offering to refund more than $37 million, but in pounds. The company said in a statement that an independent inquiry did not find any evidence of dishonesty or criminal activity, but Britain's serious fraud office is investigating. I guess the comical fraud office was busy. The investigation includes reports that the government was billed for monitoring criminals who had died. No activity on them today. The company says it had wrongly considered itself authorized to bill the government in some cases when equipment had not been installed or had already been removed. It said this practice was not consistent with its contract. You may remember the name G4S. They were heavily criticized last year for failing to meet the terms of the contract to provide security at the London Olympics. So that's two for two. The drummer of the American band Fall Out Boy, Andy Hurley, has apologized for the controversy sparked by the insensitive shirt he wore during a recent fashion event. The band performed at the Victoria's Secret fashion show, and Hurley was sporting a Rising Sun flag T-shirt. Someone contacted Fall Out Boy drummer on Twitter to let him know that the shirt in question was offensive. Please don't ignore these tweets. The Rising Sun flag symbol in your T-shirt is as bad as the Nazi flag for many Asians. It represents both imperialism and militarism of Japan in the 1940s. Realizing he made a mistake, Fall Out Boy drummer quickly issued an apology. I apologize and take responsibility for wearing something so offensive. I'll be sure to personally review costumes in advance in the future. Dateline Nashville, Tennessee. Two students at Lee University in Tennessee. Yes, named after Robert E. Lee. Why do you ask? I think. Have apologized for wearing blackface when they dressed up for a rap-themed party last week. The costumes included long white T-shirts with the title of a popular rap song by YG that includes a variation of the N-word. I wonder what it can be. The costumes became a public controversy after someone posted a photo of them online. Vice President of University Relations Jerome Hammond said the students, Carrie Klenkel and Laura Jones, have apologized. He said they did not realize how offensive their costumes might appear. Klenkel posted the apology on Twitter. Our intention was not to offend anyone in any way. Therefore, we are deeply sorry for those we have upset. The students do not have listed phone numbers, and Klenkel did not respond to a request for comment sent through social media. Deadline Sydney, Australia. A strategist for Australian Prime Minister Tony Abbott's Liberal Party apologized after describing a person widely believed to be the Indonesian foreign minister as, quote, resembling a 1970s Filipino porn star, unquote. Mark Textor made the derogatory comment on Twitter. Boy, people are getting in trouble on Twitter. As relations between Canberra, the Australian capital, and Jakarta, the Indonesian capital, plunged to the lowest point in years after a series of allegations about Australia spying on Indonesia. Who do they think they are, America? Apology demanded from Australia by a bloke who looks like a 1970s Filipino porn star and has ethics to match, said the tweet by the strategist. Some strategy, which has since been deleted. Reports said he was referring to Marty Natalegawa, who has demanded that Australia apologize after documents leaked by the U.S. whistleblower Edward Snowden showed Australia tried to listen to the phone calls of the Indonesian president, his wife, and members of his cabinet. Textor apologized, but he said he was not referring to anyone in particular. Apologies to my Indonesian friends frustrated by media-driven divisions. Twitter is indeed no place for diplomacy, he wrote, adding, conduct unbecoming. Textor is in the Prime Minister's inner circle, according to Australian sources. Maybe he'll be banished to the outer circle. That would be nice. The Fort Worth Chief of Police has personally apologized after revelations that his officers set up roadblocks for a federal drunken driving survey in which innocent drivers were stopped and asked for samples of their breath, blood, and saliva. There was a time, ladies and kids listening now, when if you offered your saliva to police, you'd be arrested. Well, if you offered it coming from where it normally comes from. Quote, we realize this survey caused many of our citizens frustration, Chief Jeffrey Halstead said In a post on the police department's Facebook page, I agree with our citizens' concerns, and I apologize for our participation. Any federal survey of this nature which jeopardizes the public's trust will not be approved, unquote. This story about the police roadblock instantly drew a public outcry, blasting police and the survey. Other drivers have said they were stopped at a similar roadblock. Drunken driving checkpoints are illegal in Texas, by the way. They like you driving drunk in Texas. The National Highway Traffic Safety Administration is paying for the $7.9 million survey. It says impaired driving accounts for thousands of deaths per year, and findings from this survey will be used to maximize the impact of policy development, education campaigns, law enforcement efforts, and other activities aimed at reducing this problem. Texas had the biggest drunken driving increase in deaths in a recent survey. Fort Worth Police spokeswoman Sergeant Kelly Peel said the officers were working off duty and were paid with federal money. He declined to give specifics about how many roadblocks were conducted or how many officers were involved. An internal investigation is underway. I pause just to remind you, ladies and gentlemen, this is all about trying to prevent some of the 50,000-plus deaths that occur on our highways every year, and people are up in arms, possibly legitimately, give them that, over a roadblock that asks for your blood and your saliva. And people are up in arms, as I say. Now, contrast this with our behavior where 3,000 people died once and all of us obligingly take off everything forever at the airport. Just saying. Back to the apologies. McDonald's has been forced to apologize after a branch in Wales played a rap song referencing violent prison rape. Well, I don't think there's nonviolent. And underage sex played the song at breakfast time. Only 17, a song produced by American rapper Rucka Rucker Ali, was played in the Pembrokeshire Haverford West branch of McDonald's while Steve Davidson was eating with his 20-month-old grandson at 9:30 in the morning. The four-minute track features graphic lyrics about having sex with a 17-year-old and being raped in prison. "It's not what you want while you're having your breakfast," said Davidson. "You have to be over 18 to download it. For them to be playing it somewhere that attracts children is obviously a concern," unquote. McDonald's attracts children? Don't they know what's in the food? McDonald's said an employee working a night shift had forgotten to unplug his music device, and so it continued to play when the store was reopened the following morning. In a statement, McDonald's representative said, "The vast majority of our restaurants have external music providers dedicated to creating playlists that have been thoroughly screened for appropriateness of language and content." I'd like that job at McDonald's. The music listener. Their statement continued, "We apologize to Mr. Davidson for this isolated lapse in our rigorous standards." So they have rigorous standards about their music. About their food? Not so much. Dateline London television maker LG has apologized to its customers for unauthorized spying by its smart TVs on the viewing habits of people who own the TVs, even after the privacy settings being in place. Even after the privacy settings are in place. And LG has promised an update to correct the problem. Britain-based IT consultant Jason Huntley, not working on the Obamacare fix apparently, found in October that his smart TV's menu system had an option called Collection of Watching Info, which was switched on by default and ultimately sends all the data to LG's servers, including the content of DVDs that may be played through the television set. Smart TV, ladies and gentlemen. Oh, for the days of dumb appliances. LG said that a firmware update is being prepared for immediate rollout that will correct this problem on all affected smart TVs, so when this feature is disabled, no further data will be transmitted. The company also clarified that the information was collected to deliver more relevant advertisements. Oh, well then, spy away. And to offer recommendations to viewers based on what other LG smart TV owners are watching. Because that's what I want to know. And it had nothing to do with the personal information of the customers, except what you're watching. That's not personal, is it? You want people to know you're listening to this show? I'll scream it from the rooftops. Now that I know, Dateline Washington, the director of the VA hospital in Augustus, Georgia, has publicly apologized for the deaths of three veterans at the facility that were caused by delays in care. Support the troops until they retire. The rare public apology from an official at the Department of Veterans Affairs was prompted by a CNN investigation that detailed the deaths at the facility and also other deaths and delays at other VA hospitals. Quote, "All of us at the Charlie Norwood VA Medical Center are deeply saddened by the loss of any veteran in our facility," says Director Robert Hamilton. "We offer our sincerest condolences to veterans affected by delays in GI care and families who have lost a loved one." Says CNN, military veterans are dying needlessly because of long waits and delayed care at U.S. veterans' hospitals. The situation has been especially dire at the William Jennings Bryan Dorn Veterans Medical Center in Columbia, South Carolina. There are veterans waiting months for simple gastrointestinal procedures. That's what they mean by GI, not have been dying because their cancers aren't caught in time. Support the troops, won't you? But wait, there's more. So much more. Retailer Costco apologized this week for labeling Bibles they were selling in their Simi Valley store in California as fiction. Pastor Caleb Kallenbach originally made the discovery when he visited the store and posted to Twitter, "Costco has Bibles for sale under the genre of fiction. Hmm." That was his tweet. He later wrote on Twitter, "Just so everyone knows, I'm not outraged, angry, or stunned. I thought the label at Costco on the Bible was interesting." Costco said in an email to Fox News, "It deeply regrets the incident and meant no offense. The books are being pulled off the shelves to be remarked," they said in their statement. They said their distributor had made an error on a small number of Bibles. However, we take responsibility and should have caught the mistake. Didn't say what category it is going to be filed under. Religious. How about that? Religious. Speaking of religion, the editor of the Harvard Ichthus, a student-run journal of Christian thought, has apologized after the site posted an article from an anonymous Jewish convert to Christianity. Quote, "We the Jews collectively rejected God and hung him up on a cross to die," the now-deleted post read, "and thus we deserve the punishments that were heaped on our heads over the last 2,000 years," unquote. Harvard senior Aaron Guide published the apology after a backlash that accused the group of promoting anti-Semitism. How is that? Quote, "We apologize for inadequate editorial oversight in the publishing and republishing of this blog post," Guide wrote, adding, "It was not the intent of the writer nor the Ichthus to present a piece that is anti-Semitic in nature or in interpretation." The author of the post, who chose to remain anonymous, told the Boston Globe, "What would I take back or change? I would emphasize more fully that it would not be justified for a Christian to persecute Jews." Atheists, have at him. No, he didn't say that. Dateline Kabul, you know where that is. It's in our friend, Afghanistan. Militants kidnapped 11 Pakistani teachers. Why is the Dateline Kabul if these are Pakistani? I have no idea. Chicago Tribune will have to account for the Dateline. Anyway, militants kidnapped 11. Oh, sorry, this isn't an apology. So who cares what the Dateline is? Education Secretary Arne Duncan has apologized this evening, whenever that was. Oh, it was a couple days ago, for using clumsy phrasing that I regret when talking about opponents of the Common Core education standards. Duncan told a gathering of state superintendents of education that, quote, "white suburban moms were upset because their kids were doing poorly on new, more rigorous exams linked to Common Core. All of a sudden, their child isn't as brilliant as they thought they were, and their school isn't quite as good as they thought, and that's pretty scary," unquote, Duncan. The remark kicked off a firestorm of protest, including a Moms Against Duncan Facebook page. Duncan now says when he mentioned the white suburban moms, he'd been trying to encourage a difficult conversation and challenge the underlying assumption that when we talk about the need to improve our nation's schools, we're only talking about poor minority students in inner cities. On the contrary, he said, every demographic group has room for improvement, unquote. MSNBC host Martin Bashir has apologized for comments he made about Sarah Palin a week ago Friday when discussing Palin's comparison of the national debt to slavery. Bashir described some of the harsh disciplinary tactics used by slave owner Thomas Thistlewood and then suggested that Palin was a candidate for such disciplinary action, which included having another slave defecate in a slave's mouth. Bashir advocated this treatment for Sarah Palin. Bashir then apologized at the beginning of his following show Monday, calling his comments unacceptable. I wanted to take this opportunity to say sorry to Mrs. Palin and to also offer an unreserved apology to her friends and family, her supporters, our viewers, and anyone who may have heard what I said. Bashir said, I deeply regret what I said and that I have learned a sober lesson in these last few days, that the politics of vitriol and destruction is a miserable place to be and a miserable person to become, but a great place to have a cable news channel at. He didn't say that. Alec Baldwin got his show suspended for a couple weeks for less by the same channel. And finally, ladies and gentlemen, the cooperative banks, this is in England, the cooperative banks, it's a cooperative, former chairman Paul Flowers has apologized for his stupid and wrong behavior and said he's seeking professional help after a video was published showing the Methodist minister, yes, he runs a bank and he's a Methodist minister too, the video showed him handing over money to buy hard drugs. Who does he think he is? Rob Ford? The footage showed Flowers counting out £300 in cash and asking if he could also get hold of some ketamine. A friend of Flowers handed over the footage to the Mail newspaper, recorded days after the former cooperative bank chairman gave testimony to the Treasury Committee in Parliament over the bank's £700 million in losses. The whistleblower, Stuart Davies, handed over the video in a series of incriminating text messages after becoming disgusted by the hypocrisy of a man who had chaired the anti-drugs charity Lifeline and who had written columns about the evils of drug use. After being confronted with the material, Flowers, 63, referred to the pressures of his job and dealing with a family bereavement. At the lowest point in this terrible period, he said, I did things that were stupid and wrong. I'm sorry for this, and I'm seeking professional help and apologize to all I have hurt or failed by my actions. The bank had no comment. The Methodist Church said a thorough investigation would take place, maybe even a methodical one. The apologies of the week, ladies and gentlemen, a copyrighted feature of this broadcast. And now,
I guess I'm just lucky so-and-so.
Well, we haven't had this feature for a couple of weeks. And so there's been a virtual flowering of the phenomenon in the interim. The best place to have a flowering is in the interim. So today I feature first an interview from To the Point, KCRW's To the Point, then Janet Yellen's testimony. She's going to become the head of the Federal Reserve. Then an excerpt from NPR's Science Friday, and finally something from WBUR in Boston. So sit back, relax, and enjoy some interviewees beginning the answers to questions. Inexplicably, my humble opinion, with the word so.
Tell us a bit about your program, what it's done in the past, and what it's being what's doing now.
So, Humanitarian OpenStreetMap team, we work with both the OpenStreetMap community, which is a global volunteer community that does mapping in a completely open source volunteer way for all sorts of purposes.
How are they updated?
That's absolutely right. So most of what the OpenStreetMap team is doing, the humanitarian OpenStreetMap team, and of course, Mikhail can correct me as he set this up and knows better than I do.
What's the role of crowdsourcing?
Absolutely. So this kind of task, you know, OpenStreetMap is, as you said, the Wikipedia of maps.
So that's absolutely so. And now here's Janet Yellen.
How should the FOMC move forward on an exit strategy?
So, Senator, I think that there are dangers, frankly, on both sides.
How do you respond to the concerns that quantitative easing has limited impact on economic growth and is, in fact, creating very serious risks in our financial markets?
So, a number of different studies have been done attempting to assess what the contribution of our asset purchases have been.
What specific changes to that would be required to earn your public support?
So I strongly, as I've indicated, support transparency and openness on the part of the Fed.
Do you agree that the FSOC has and should exercise its authority to develop industry-specific guidance and metrics rather than forcing insurers or asset managing firms, for example, into a bank-centric regulatory model?
So, Senator, I do believe that one size fits all should not be the model for regulation.
Will you be willing to make that commitment to transparency as it applies to the FSOC?
So I will need to study this issue more closely in terms of what FSOC's procedures are.
Would you consider that possibility of, in effect, in sending the banks to get this capital not on your balance sheet, but back out into the marketplace to stimulate more loans and more private capital into the market?
So, Senator, that is something that the FOMC has discussed.
Can you maybe chew on this a little bit in terms of your perspectives?
So, Senator, we're involved in a very comprehensive review.
What would the markets do then?
So, Senator, as you indicated, the Federal Reserve and other agencies did have concerns about this rule.
And isn't it possible that we could end up creating a real problem as we try to exit from this?
So, Senator, you made a number of different points.
I think we would see how big those asset bubbles are. Wouldn't you agree with me on that?
So, I think with respect to real estate, you mentioned real estate markets, and we certainly are seeing, as you mentioned, private investors come in to invest in often all cash.
And now, going back from public affairs to public radio.
What have you got today cooking for?
So, funny you would say cooking. So, today we're going to explore a phenomenon known as the Leidenfrost effect. So you've probably seen this while you've been cooking. So you take a pan.
How do you define clean eating?
Sure. So, I mean, I look at it in a couple of different ways. But what kind of review process did restaurants have to go through to be included in your guidebook?
Sure. So we have a multi-step process.
Why? Isn't seitan considered a health food?
So what happens is with a lot of the vegetarian and vegan restaurants, they need to replace animal proteins.
How do you determine that? How does it work in practice?
So there's no perfect way of determining it. So there are some tests that are out there.
So, ladies and gentlemen, that's our roundup of the week in So. And so's your old man, by the way, in addition to all that. A copyrighted feature of this broadcast. And now, news from outside the bubble. Absolutely. So, this from the Independent newspaper in London. The United States is playing the lead role in delaying the publication of the long-awaited report into how Britain went to war with Iraq, the Independent has learned. Although the British Cabinet Office has been under fire for stalling the progress of the four-year-long Iraq inquiry by Sir John Chilcot, senior diplomatic sources in the U.S. and Britain indicated that it is officials in the White House and the Department of State who've refused to approve any declassification of critical pre-war communications between George Bush and Tony Blair. Without permission from the U.S. government, Prime Minister David Cameron faces the politically embarrassing situation of having to block evidence on Washington's orders from being included in the report of the expensive and lengthy British inquiry. Earlier this year, the same newspaper revealed that early drafts of the report challenged the official version of events leading up to the Iraq War. The protected documents relating to the Bush-Blair exchanges are said to provide crucial evidence for already written passages that are highly critical of the covert way in which Blair committed British troops to the U.S.-led invasion. One high-placed diplomatic source said the U.S. is highly possessive when documents relate to the presence of the president or anyone close to him. Tony Blair is involved in a dialogue in many of these documents, and naturally someone else is at the other end, the president. Therefore, this is not Tony Blair's or the U.K. government's property to disclose. Last week, Chilcot sent the Prime Minister an update on his inquiry's progress, which explained his continuing inability to set a publication date. He described difficult discussions with the government on the disclosure of material he wanted to include in a report or publish alongside it. He should have just insisted on the deadline and then He said over the past 6 months, he had submitted requests that covered 200 cabinet-level discussions, the cache of notes from Blair to Bush, and more than 130 records of conversations between Blair or Prime Minister Gordon Brown and the White House. Chilcott is a former diplomat who previously investigated intelligence on Iraq's supposed weapons of mass destruction as part of another inquiry. That one came out. The authors are facing difficult choices forced on them by Washington and the Cabinet Office's desire not to upset the so-called special relationship between Britain and the United States. They may deliver a neutered report in spring of next year, which would effectively absolve Blair of any serious policy failures because there would be no clear evidence contained in the report to back up direct criticism. Another possibility is the report will be so heavily redacted as to be rendered meaningless and hence a waste of almost $15 million of British taxpayers' money. I think I know how that would be described by supporters of President Bush. Mission accomplished.
Gone back home, T9D, to the land of the beautiful queen. Gone back home to my baby, going back to New Orleans. On the step, here come the Neville brothers.
Sing that neck, my brother.
Going back home, T9D, but never more will I roam. Gonna get my fill of that A2B, cause New Orleans is my home.
Going back home.
Meanwhile, in London, this is Le Show, and now, ladies and gentlemen, news of Nice Corp, nice people doing nice things. Rupert Murdoch, chairman of Nice Corp, has agreed to a settlement that will complete the divorce from his third wife, Wendy Deng Murdoch, after 14 years of marriage. Murdoch filed for divorce in June. The couple has a prenup, according to a person familiar with the matter. Because, you know, prenups are nice. Wendy will keep the couple's Fifth Avenue residence in New York City. I know you were wondering about that as part of the settlement. Rupert keeps the Los Angeles house. Rupert said in papers filed in New York State Supreme Court in Manhattan that the relationship had broken down irretrievably. The couple shook hands before the hearing and briefly embraced afterwards. Because that's the nice way to be. But I never usually use this as a news source. But normal scruples don't apply in this particular case. The Mail on Sunday reports relations between Rupert Murdoch and Tony Blair, aforementioned Tony Blair, former Prime Minister of Britain, have collapsed over reports of Blair's friendship with Murdoch's ex-wife, Wendy Deng. Blair has always maintained his friendship with Deng as platonic. Murdoch has said to regard the rift with Blair as, quote, terminal, and has refused to speak to Blair since Rupert filed for divorce from Deng. Blair has tried to contact Murdoch, but has been rebuffed. That's not nice. Sources close to Murdoch say staff at his home in California claim Blair and Deng stayed there overnight at the same time on weekends in October 2012 and on April this year without Rupert's knowledge. It also claimed Blair and Deng had multiple encounters of which Murdoch was unaware, including a weekend overnight stay at Murdoch's home in Los Angeles and meetings in London and New York. Then lawyers step in and make the newspaper say this, quote, there is no suggestion by this newspaper of any impropriety by Mr. Blair or Mrs. Deng. They quote a close friend of Blair saying Rupert Murdoch is putting out ridiculous stories about Wendy and Tony Blair, which are not true. It is the ravings of a sad old man, unquote, a close friend of Tony Blair. A friend of News Corporation boss Murdoch says Rupert Murdoch will have nothing more to do with Tony Blair. Not ever, unquote. That's how it goes at the top of Nice Corp. Nice people doing nice things. Ladies and gentlemen, I mentioned earlier Toronto Mayor, they call it Toronto in Toronto, Toronto Mayor Rob Ford, back in the news this week, pushing a council person at the meeting of the Toronto City Council, caught on tape, caught on video, why not? And he and his brother Doug, who had a radio program, it's not uncommon for mayors in some cities to have radio programs, they'd been given, when the eruption over the mayor's alleged and then admitted use of cocaine and crack occurred, the radio show was canceled, but a Canadian TV network, which is likened by some observers to Fox News, then offered them their own TV show, which this week was canceled after one episode. But it's not all dark up there.
The temperature's flirting with freezing, though the skies are sunny and dry. Cold but wintry and pleasing, and the holiday spirits are high. In Canada's largest city, the winds are starting to blow. But in all of Greater Toronto, there's just one place you'll find Christmas snow. City Hall, corner office, mahogany desk by the window. You don't pay any fines when you do a few lines. The Yuletide snows of Toronto. The Yuletide snows of Toronto. And clean, but this Christmas do come exploring for a very new wintertime scene. On the floors of the Hudson's Bay Company, the gifts they are starting to pack. But although he's losing some powers, Rob Ford still got plenty of crack. City Hall, corner office, he's the ranger and his brother is Tonto. An official gift that can give you a lift. The Yuletide snows of Toronto. The Yuletide snows. Of Toronto. The season just calls for believing, though this is so hard to conceive. It's giving as well as receiving. Nothing's what he's got up his sleeve. To holiday spirits he's not immune. There's a bottle or two on his shelf, the gift that never stops giving. It's the gift that's known as himself. City Hall, corner office, you might want to get there pronto. These are the snows that tingle the nose, the Yuletide snows of Toronto. Tight snows of Toronto.
And now, ladies and gentlemen, news of the Olympic movement, produced by Jim Ebersole Jr. First, an update. Journalists at the 2014 Olympic Games in Sochi, Russia, will be able to take photographs and shoot videos for their own personal use without having to worry about loss of accreditation. The International Olympic Committee announced this week. Photographs taken by participants and other accredited individuals during the course of the Games may be published on social media, but they may not be sold or used for any other commercial purpose except by officially accredited photographers, according to the IOC. At the same time, a video may be used exclusively for personal use, rules prohibiting its use on any social networks, blogs, and websites. This corrects the reports that had appeared in the Russian and American media, and here, the journalists at the 2014 Games would be banned from using mobile phones to capture sports people and spectators. The IOC statement makes it clear there will be no fundamental differences between the work of journalists during the Sochi Olympics and during the Summer Olympics in London. So there you go. But now, there's more. Deadline Rio de Janeiro. Olympic sports federations will be monitoring efforts to clean up the polluted waters around Rio to prevent health risks to athletes at the 2016 Games. Just 2.5 years before the Olympics, an Associated Press report published earlier this week showed nearly 70% of Rio's sewage is untreated and dumped into iconic beach areas like Copacabana and Ipanema and into picturesque Guanabara Bay. Now you know why the girl is from Ipanema. Those waters will host several of Rio's events at the Olympics and Paralympics. FINA, the world governing body of swimming, as you well know, said Friday that its sports medicine committee would check water conditions just before the Games. The marathon swimming event will be held off of Copacabana, and also the swimming portion of the triathlon will be held there. Rio organizers had pledged to Olympic officials that the pollution would be cleaned up after decades of neglect and poor planning. In data obtained by the Associated Press, the measurement of fecal coliform bacteria in Copacabana went up 16 times above the Brazilian government's satisfactory level as recently as 3 weeks ago. The most deeply rooted problem is Guanabara Bay, which will hold sailing events. The bay has become a polluted dump where few locals expect the poor dare to swim. We're for sure concerned about it, and we're in discussion with the organizing committee about it, says Jerome Pels, chief executive of sailing's world governing body, the ISAF, as you well know. We know with reports we're getting from sailors who are training there that already there are some concerns. It's on our radar. Rio organizers have been pressed by the International Olympic Committee to speed up building venues. Cleaning the water could add to delays in preparing for the Games, which are costing about $15 billion in public and private money. Reorganizers add the water quality is the responsibility of state government. The Secretary of the Environment for the state of Rio de Janeiro, Carlos Mink, acknowledged the bay's contamination has been festering for years. The Rio State's Environmental Agency has classified nearly all 13 bayside beaches it monitors as terrible. That's a quote. That the bay is rotten and the beaches are polluted, everyone has known this for 20 years, Mink said in an interview with the Brazilian newspaper. This is nothing new. What is new is that now we have a different response than before. Mink mentions that cooperation is needed from Rio City government. Many delays in preparing the Rio Olympics have been caused by conflicts between among Brazil's three levels of government, local, state, and national. What a silly way to organize. Did they get that idea? And a major parliamentary report into the London 2012 Olympics warns that the prospect of an effective and robust legacy from the Games is in jeopardy unless there's a change in government approach. The House of Lords Select Committee on Olympic and Paralympic Legacies says the Games need a government to appoint a minister with overall responsibility for producing legacy benefits, which are in danger of faltering. There's little evidence of increased participation in sports. There are uneven distribution of economic benefits from the Games across the country. And they also criticize UK sport for its no-compromise policy on sports without short-term medal prospects. They won't support sports in Britain anymore that don't have an immediate prospect of medal winners. This approach has an inherent bias against team sports and fails to help emerging sports, says the committee. Which also says there's confusion on the time frames and targets involved in delivery and the lack of clear ownership of legacy as a whole. The Olympics, ladies and gentlemen. It's a movement. And we all need one. Every day. Apropos of what I was speaking about at the beginning of the show, the lawsuit against the oil companies for damage to the wetlands of South Louisiana, the New Orleans Sometimes-Picayune reports the loss of Gulf of Mexico wetlands has more than doubled between 2004 and 2009 when compared to an earlier five-year period, quoting a federal report released this week. The rising rate contributed to the Gulf Coast accounting for 71% of total U.S. wetlands loss during those years. The losses were largely attributed to the effects of severe coastal storms, but the study also pointed to the adverse effects of oil and gas development, quote, which has increased the vulnerability of these wetlands to climate-related changes. So why sue them? Don't you think that's a little extreme? Ladies and gentlemen, that's going to conclude this week's edition of the show. The program returns next week at the same time over these same stations on NPR worldwide throughout Europe, the USN 440 cable system in Japan, around the world through the facilities of the American Forces Network, up and down the east coast of North America by the shortwave giant WBCQ, the planet, 7.490 megahertz shortwave on the mighty 104 in Berlin, available for your smartphone through Stitcher.com, available as a free podcast. Wow. Did I mention we're available via the internet at two different locations? No, I didn't. So I'm not going to. available as a free podcast from WWNO.org. We're available on the internet streaming at KCSN.org. And it would be just like me getting that last little spiel correct. If you'd agree to join with me then, would you already? Thank you very much. Uh-huh. Show chapeau to the San Diego, Pittsburgh, Chicago, and Exile and Hawaii desks. Thanks, as always, to Pam Halstead, and thanks to Adrian Bodnam here at Global Radio in London for help with today's broadcast. The show comes to you from Century of Progress Productions and originates through the facilities of WWNO New Orleans, flagship station of the Change is Easy radio network. This ends the 30th year of the show. We'll see you next week to start another one.